Before we begin this podcast, I'd like to tell you about a special deal. Subscribe today to The Spectator for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with, here's the magic bit, a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal and I'm joined today by The Spectator's Isabel Hardman and Luke Trill of More in Common. Now, Isabel, last week the Prime Minister made a big pitch on benefits changes and announced there are going to be different ways in which benefits are assessed in future. Talk us through these changes and whether you think they're likely to succeed in trying to get down some of that welfare bill which built up post-COVID.
Yeah, these benefit reforms have been in the works, as with a lot of government reforms, for a very long time. And I think there's been four different secretaries of state for work and pensions who've been working on them over the past couple of years. So you can see Chloe Smith, Therese Coffey, as well as Mel Stride, all having input into this question of how do you pay and assess benefits for today rather than for the context of the last set of welfare reforms around universal credit, which were obviously started actually by the Conservatives when they were in opposition in 2009. And our health as a nation has changed, and COVID has, I suppose, magnified that, but it was changing before then anyway. And this green paper, so it's very much the consultative document as opposed to a set of reforms that are going to happen. This green paper attempts to address some of the questions around whether the personal independence payment, which replaced the disability living allowance, which is paid to people both in and out of work, it's not an off-work benefit, whether that's being paid in the most appropriate way, whether it's actually keeping people out of the workplace. So some people who are on PIP, who are currently out of work, don't want to take a job for fear that they have a reassessment and then lose their current PIP entitlement that they still need to be able to get into work, because PIP is all about sort of your mobility and your ability to live an independent life. So there have been lots of concerns in the works for a long time. One of Therese Coffey's criticisms of it was that the assessment, both for PIP and whether you were fit to work in general, tended to look at what people couldn't do as opposed to what people could still do. And it was it's had many iterations over the years, but some of those iterations involved, can you pick up an empty cardboard box? Which, I mean, I can't remember the last time I had to do that as part of my spectator duties. Maybe not even a full cardboard box, actually. There are lots of valid concerns about this. However, that's a very long preamble to the reason why it's happening now. And there are two reasons. One is we have the local elections, and Rishi Sunak is trying to do his fight back before the local election results. And we'll get on to talking about that, about why he might want to do that with Luke in a minute. The other is that the benefits bill, and particularly sickness benefit, is now huge. And you've got, I think, 2.8 million people out of work on benefits, and more than half of those have reported some kind of mental health condition, including, according to the government literature, bad nerves, which is not a phrase I've read since studying Jane Austen, I think. But I think the reason that's been included is there is what some campaigners fear to be a bit of a trivialising of mental illness by some ministers. And, you know, I think there's a valid debate to be had about whether we've ended up in a kind of place where celebrity mental health culture has meant that everyone has a diagnosis, and that whether actually having a diagnosis means, right, now's the time to get the treatment, or whether it's, no, I just can't do this for the rest of my life. And that's, you know, that's a whole other podcast. But there's definite frustration that the Conservatives have been picking up from their voters with what is now known in Whitehall as mental health culture, which sounds fun, mental health culture. Probably won't be going to the fringe of that, the Edinburgh Festival. So that's the kind of the political backdrop to it. And that's why this green paper has been announced now, as opposed to any time over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years where you've had ministers looking at it.
Luke, Isabel there talks about how, you know, the debate around mental health has perhaps changed. You remember, you know, about 12 years ago, I think Charles Walker gave the first speech on mental health in Parliament. What does the polling say on this? I mean, 10 years ago, the Conservatives, of course, had a big change in benefits to the universal credit system. How has the debate evolved, both in attitudes towards mental health and welfare in this area as well?
Well, we're starting with welfare in general. It is right to say that the public tend to think that it is too easy to claim benefits. So about sort of 45% of people say it's too easy versus 18% who say it's too hard. And there is very definitely strong support for measures that support people who are on benefits back into work. I actually think post the pandemic, there's been this rise in concern about people who are becoming isolated. They don't have contact. And so I think a lot of the stuff that Mel Stride talked about previously, which was about how do we support people back into work. I actually think, well, we know from our focus group discussion, it was quite popular because people do want to see people getting back to work, not just for the economic reason, but also because they think it's good for them. I think the mistake in the way that the announcements this week have been pitched in terms of public opinion is that they now seem to be more punitive. There was an element, if you looked at that sort of Times front page, depressed and anxious, risk losing their benefits. And I think that is where they might well end up on the wrong side of public opinion. You talk about changing attitudes. 7 in 10 of the public say that they sometimes or often worry about the mental health of their friends and family. That's a really significant statistic. Around half know someone close to them who has an ongoing mental health problem. And so, you know, there's this increased awareness. And if you ask people why has there been this rise? There are some people who say, you know, we complain too much these days. We're less resilient than we used to be. It's about 3 in 10 say that. But the vast majority go for it's less taboo. You can talk about this now, and you couldn't. 61% give that as a reason. But also, interestingly, people link it to the cost of living crisis and the pandemic and the extra stressors that they put on people. And the really interesting thing, I think this is where you find the real risk of the Conservatives ending up on the wrong side of a wedge that they might be trying to create, is that the public still don't believe that workplaces are taking this seriously enough. Just 7% say workplaces treat mental health too seriously or take it too seriously, versus 50% who say not seriously enough and others don't know. Or in between, you know, in polling terms, that is a big margin. And so I guess the concern for the Conservatives is with that shift in tone, with it sounding a little bit like it might be sort of ascribing a bit more blame, personal responsibility, they risk actually appealing to quite a small group. I just give you, you know, one more data point, because it's the word that always comes into these conversations, is mental health a woke issue? It's around 1 in 5 say that it is. The rest of people don't say that. So as a sort of rallying the base pre-local elections, maybe, because, you know, that 1 in 5 who see it as a woke issue tend to be older, they tend to be more socially conservative. But for the rest of the country and for that general election audience, I think there is a risk of backfire if this is seen as being too much stick rather than carrot.
Isabel, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with what Luke's saying. And he's absolutely right that there's a shift in the way that government has sort of picked up people's concerns. So it is absolutely right to say that, you know, being back in work is what most people who have mental health problems want to be doing. The question is whether they're well enough to do it. And the answer that the government should be giving is, well, we'll give you the support that enables you to recover. But that was missing from, you know, I read the Green Paper yesterday, I watched Mel Stride's statement in the Commons, all of that was missing. And you had Conservative MPs like Chloe Smith, mentioned, you know, former Work and Pensions Secretary, former Disability Minister, has done a lot of thinking on this. And also Ruth Edwards, who's the Tory MP for Rushcliffe, who actually talked about her own battle with anxiety before she became an MP. And she grew quite emotional whilst talking about that. And just as an aside, I think it's great that Tory MPs now just, you know, Tory Labour MPs all talk about their own mental health problems and it doesn't even get reported anymore because it's just so normal for that to happen. I think that's fab. But both Smith and Edwards were asking about whether there would be the treatment and support for people with mental health problems available on the NHS to get back into work. And that is the big missing piece. And the frustration that, you know, campaigners and I guess, you know, people like me who have sort of, you know, banged on about their mental health ad nauseam for quite a while, the frustration that we have is that this is not a sudden surprise that NHS waiting lists for talking therapies and occupational health have been really bad for a good number of years, and that the NHS has consistently missed all of its targets. I don't think it's made a single target in terms of mental health treatment, whether that be access to psychological therapies, which, you know, can still be very basic, or you know, inpatient admission or whatever. And so it feels a little bit as though ministers are upbraiding people for breaking the social contract by not going to work, while not acknowledging that they've not kept their side of the contract by not providing the support for them to get back into work. So I feel a little as though we should remind ministers that they also need to turn up to work too.
Luke, you mentioned there about rallying the base ahead of the local elections. One of the fascinating dimensions of these locals is going to be the 11 mayoralties, and in particular, what's happening in the West Midlands, where Andy Street is battling for his political life.
Yeah, so we looked at four mayoral races. We looked at West Midlands, Greater Manchester, the North East and the East Midlands, which are both new. It was really interesting. The West Midlands was absolutely fascinating because firstly, our poll came back and it showed Andy Street 2 points ahead of his Labour opponent. In polling, of course, you know, we see that as a statistical tie. It basically means the race is neck and neck. But when you look, we asked a second question, which was about Andy Street's personal approval. Do people think he's doing a good job or a bad job? And he was on plus 16 on that. Now, that might not sound particularly impressive, but if you compare that with national politicians, if you compare that with Rishi Sunak, if you even compare that with Keir Starmer, it is way higher. And for a politician in the current environment to have a positive approval rating in the double digits is really quite significant. We did some focus group work to dig into, you know, what was motivating people, you know, why did they like Andy Street so much? And whilst, you know, I think Rishi Sunak will take the win if it comes, I don't think the answers people gave were particularly encouraging for the Conservatives. There was a lot of, I don't really see him as a Conservative. He stands up for everyone. He definitely got brownie points for HS2 and the way he was seen to distance himself, not just distance himself, but criticise the National Party. And so he's managed this kind of big tent appeal in Birmingham and the wider West Midlands, which might, and again, you know, as I say, the polling shows it's too close call, might just be enough to outrun the drag. And it is very definitely a drag if you compare it with general election voting intention that the National Tory brand has on him. Won't surprise you to know that in Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham looks set to cruise to re-election there. Again, very positive approval rating. There's a real difference between mayors and Westminster politicians. More interesting in Greater Manchester, I think, is the battle for second, where we had Reform actually narrowly ahead of the Conservatives, which would be quite a significant result, although the reason that might not translate in reality is Reform, obviously not standing local councillors, doesn't have that infrastructure to turn people out. In the East Midlands, Conservatives, I think, were quite pleased when they recruited Ben Bradley, who is the MP for Mansfield, Nottinghamshire County Council leader, big levelling up champion. Unfortunately for Ben, it looks like he won't be successful. We had him 14 points behind his Labour opponent, not having built up that personal brand. And then the final race that we looked at was in the North East, where Labour could be in more trouble than we might have first assumed. We found that Labour's Kim McGuinness was only 2 points ahead of independent Jamie Driscoll. Driscoll, of course, the mayor of North of Tyne. Authority was blocked for standing from Labour and decided to run as an independent candidate. And what we picked up in the focus groups was there was a big, you know, we've known for a while there's a big kind of pox on all your houses mood. In most places, that's translating into, well, let's just get the Tories out, even if we're unenthusiastic about Labour. But actually, we had lots of people saying, well, look, this is a way not to vote for the two parties. But that said, the reason Driscoll was running it close was he was taking a good chunk of 2019 Tories, interestingly, who were breaking to vote for him, but also his voters were more likely to turn out. So if Labour can get their vote out, it shouldn't be that close. But, you know, if turnout remains as the poll projected, then it will be close. And then very finally, of course, there's been a few polls by others, by YouGov and Redfield and Wilton, which suggests that Tees Valley is also close. Although YouGov yesterday had him 7 points up, actually, which is a bit of a wider margin, suggesting that he's perhaps got an easier job than Andy Street. And of course, he got 72% of the vote at the last election. If he lost, and imagining that swing which made him lose was repeated across the country, the Conservatives would be left with 3 or 4 seats in a general election. So it would be pretty seismic. But taken together, it means that, you know, whilst I don't think you can do a huge read across from mayoral races to national politics, there is at least the potential for the kernel of a narrative for Rishi Sunak to come out of those elections saying, well, look, we held the West Midlands, we held on in Tees Valley, Labour were run close in what should have been their heartland in the northeast. Maybe this isn't as game, set and match as you think. Now, you know, as I say, that might not be particularly accurate read, but it is at least a read you can give, and the sort of thing which might actually really matter in terms of the morale boost that Tory MPs need going into the summer.
Thank you, Luke. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you for listening to Coffee Hour Shots.